Okay, Andrew. Thank you for coming. I'm going to take care of a few housekeeping matters first, just so you're not running out the door at the end and you don't get to hear that. We're taking a break at Lou Jones in January, but we will have one in February. Mark your calendars. The date will be February 5th, and we don't have a topic yet, but we will, TBD. We will also have Lou Jones in March, and the presenters will be folks from U.S. Attorney's, U.S. Trustee's Office, U.S. Trustee's Office.
Sorry, what? Yeah.
You're right. Okay, on subchapter 5 of chapter 11. But we're waiting to see when this room is available, which is why we don't have the specific date in March yet. You have folks attending here from Oshkosh. Thanks to you. People in Green Bay must be Christmas shopping, and now we have someone in Eau Claire. Welcome. Today we have cookies by Paula. You thought we weren't going to have those anymore, but we do have some cookies at the back. Paula Bartels is back, and she is now our HR guru here at the park, so we're very happy about that. Might have to break the cookies up and share, but they're here. So we're glad. Now to the main event. We're very happy to have Richard Grossnick here from Chief Legal Counsel Office for the IRS. This is his third time giving a Lou Jones presentation. They're always very thorough, comprehensive. You should have the outline. It's been available on the court's website under the Lou Jones link. But Richard has always been very gracious with his time, providing helpful commentary on FICR listserv and making himself available for your calls. That's going to somewhat selfishly come to an end because he's retiring, good for him. But our loss, why don't we clap for him now for all his.
I told Judge Hannon to get the applause up front because it certainly won't be after my lecture. We're about the written material. This is a condensed version of an outline I did for the Wisconsin State Bar CLE a couple years ago. I tried to update it, kind of like a last will and testament. It's pretty much everything I know about bankruptcy, at least as far as my interactions with your office and various offices go. The only mistake that I'm aware of is, I think around page 13, I mentioned that Teresa Anzalino is one of the administrative attorneys in the district. She's actually the U.S. attorney for the Western District, or at least the one that handles the bankruptcy matters. In Eastern, Lisa Ewing has been handling the bankruptcy matter. She's starting to wind down a little bit to transfer her workload to a fellow named Carter Stewart. So I think we'll be dealing primarily with him moving forward unless they hire somebody else from the U.S. Attorney's Office, because, of course, as you know, it's always doing their own protocol. So as I was preparing for the lecture today, I was going over it this weekend, and my wife was listening and trying to be helpful. She said, you know, that's really depressing. She said, can't you say at least one good thing? And I thought about it, I'm like, yeah, well, one good thing is I'm retiring. Right? So that's my one good thing to tell you today is I'm retiring. I'm going to be riding off into the sunset. And I've been asked by some folks, well, what are you going to be doing in retirement? Are you going to be, you know, maybe practicing legal work? No, I'm surrendering my law license on the 24th of January when I walk away. What I'm really going to be doing is something fun. You guys remember this from my previous lectures, right? Well, this is a new and improved version. This is got 38 points of articulation. You can pose him. You can make him walk and move, and he is perfect for stop-motion animation films, which is what I'll be doing. So, like the old King Kong, you know, the old King Kong movie, basically you pose this in various ways and you film it, and it actually makes quite an interesting film. But to have a good film, you need more than just one monster, right? So I was fortunate enough, as a Christmas gift to myself, to get another monster.
right?
Okay, this is my pride and joy. Got it from Japan. And it's just great. It looks great on film. One small problem. Right? It's too big. Too big and too heavy. Right? So use it for what it's intended for. Stick it in the background. It's not too bad. But if you try to push it or use it in ways that it's not meant to be used for, it breaks. All right? So, great, wonderful, Richard. What does that have to do with bankruptcy? Well, the Internal Revenue Service, back in 2000, decided that with your 2K problems, they needed to upgrade their computer system, right? So spent a lot of money, and of course, being a government agency, they went over budget, way over time, all right? But basically, they have a situation where most of the major tax modules have now been upgraded. So the 1040s that you file at the end of the year, the business returns, the 941s, the 1120s, those are all on our new system, okay? But what happened in 2014, Congress cut our budget, and so the modernization program slowed down. And so now the money that is spent on modernization is being spent to upgrade for the new tax laws that get passed, but only to the core system. The peripheral systems that were never upgraded continue to motor along in their old forms. And of course, what's our main peripheral system? Solvency. So the Solvency is still working on a program that was written originally back in the 60s and not really modified a whole lot since then. Okay? What does that mean for you? What that means for you is that our system can do certain things pretty well. It files proofs of claim. It enters codes in when you file for bankruptcy to let us know that we shouldn't be collecting against your clients. Right? It doesn't really do much of anything else beyond that. And what has been happening since 2014 is with counsel getting less involved in the bankruptcy process, and Solvency has had to take on more and varied duties, and they've been trying to push this system into various places it was never meant to go. And it started breaking. This past year, 2019, our system within the insolvency module that handles refunds was offline for roughly 7 of the 12 months. It means we issued no refunds other than haphazard ones that went out without anybody being able to figure out why they went out. But no systemic refunds for 7 months. I don't think it's going to get much better next year. All right? I've been trying to get insolvency to admit A, there's a problem, that they know what the problem is, and see that they're working to fix it. Not a word. Okay? So for your clients who are coming to you looking for refunds, it's going to be a bad year coming up. All right? And the ones I feel most sorry for are the trustees. Because the trustees, if you overpay us, you're still waiting for refunds. In some instances, going back 3-4 months. All right? Yes, we're working on that. Do I know when it's going to happen? No. So in line with that, what I've tried to do in the outline is to provide ways that you can work around this and some of the other problems that we are going to be encountering as time moves forward. And I'll try to go through some of those with you. The biggest problem, of course, is that I've been acting as a buffer the last 4 or 5 years to kind of, you know, take the problems that you're giving me and figure out what insolvency can deal with that and fix it. Well, that worked well when we had insolvency staff. Right? When I started here in 2011, our insolvency staff in Wisconsin was 11 people, including a senior technical advisor, Val Thomas, who was excellent, his supervisor, Tiffany Lentz, and a number of insolvency specialists that were very skilled in what they did. Right? As you all know, that number has significantly shrunk, and we're now down to 2 people, Linda Latz and Barb Bishop. How long will Linda and Barb be with us? I have no idea. Both of them have neuromuscular diseases that are progressive. They will stay here as long as they are physically able to. At some point, they will no longer be able to physically work, and they will retire. Will we replace them? Well, a year ago, I would have said no, because I didn't see any insolvency hiring anywhere in the country. But lo and behold, with some additional money that Congress got us last year, they decided that they were going to try to replace or get some new insolvency people into some of the critical areas where we were really short of insolvency staff, like Wisconsin. So last summer, we got offered, or Solvency got authorization to hire new people. Back in May, they brought on their first new hire. She lasted 20 days. At the end of the 20 days, she said, you know, this is just crazy, the amount of work to do. I don't need this for the price that they're paying. She walked. Well, they were able to fortunately get in a second hire, which is almost unprecedented. And that person lasted 15 days. So you have no new insolvency people for Wisconsin, no idea if we're going to be hiring new insolvency people, or the insolvency people we have here are going to gradually decline. All right? So what does that leave you? Well, that leaves you with people outside of the state of Wisconsin to handle your insolvency. So we have people who are in New York, people who are in Minnesota, people who are in Indiana, Ohio, Louisville, Kentucky, Missouri. I think there's one other state that has handled Wisconsin. It changes, or could potentially change, every 3 months as they juggle the inventory. The people outside of Wisconsin, they don't know Wisconsin law, they don't know anything, so they try to treat you the way that their own jurisdictions get treated. Right? And there's some significant differences in the way their jurisdictions are treated. The biggest difference that I've run across in the last year is the way that they handle return filings. So if you have a situation where you need to be compliant with the four-year rule or Judge Halpiger's three-and-a-half-year rule, okay, and provide for those tax returns to get into the IRS, the Internal Revenue Manual, which is the guidance for all of the insolvency, says that you can amend the proof of claim if and only if the IRS has received and processed that return. In other words, we've gotten the return, we've taken it, it's gone through the audit process, and we've determined that there's nothing left to increase the amount that's owed. Well, that's great from our standpoint. From your standpoint, you're looking at 6 to 9 months after filing that occurred. I don't think too many of you have that much time in your Chapter 13s to be able to wait for us. All right? But that is the standard across the United States. So what I try to do is I try to find a happy medium. And so what I said was, well, look, if you can provide me with a copy of the return that was filed, a signed copy of the return, I will ask Insolvency to take that, and we will assume, for purposes of amending the proof of claim, that it's going to go through, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, actually almost 98% of the returns that we receive in Insolvency are processed without any changes. And even if there are changes, it's a post-petition assessment. You can deal with that, right? Well, Milwaukee Insolvency is doing that. Other jurisdictions are less inclined to do that. And one of the reasons they're less inclined to do it is that things didn't work out the way I anticipated. So instead of sending me or sending Insolvency these returns and giving us a chance to look them over and amend the proof of claim, people would send them in, and then if the claim wasn't amended within 24 hours, they'd file an objection. So not so much here in Eastern, but in Western, completely swamped the U.S. Attorney's Office with these objections. All right. So that Insolvency, being battered both by the attorneys and by the U.S. Attorney, said, we're going back to our old system. We're just going to take them when they get processed. Right. I think I have got them persuaded that the consequences of that are not worth going into. So I believe everyone who is dealing with Wisconsin cases at this point in time will accept it if you send the insolvency specialist a signed copy of the returns that you're filing. Not send the originals. They are not a processing center. They will simply take them and put them in their file. That's not going to get the process. You've got to send them in like you ordinarily would, whether that's electronically or by paper. But if you send a signed copy to the insolvency specialist, they will amend the proof of claim based on that information, and that should hopefully make everybody happy. How do you know who the insolvency specialist is? Well, you look at the proof of claim. The proof of claim has got the insolvency specialist's name and direct phone number. Will they pick up and answer you? I hope not. They don't have the time to be able to chat with you on the phone, all right? But if you leave a message, they will get back to you, particularly if you leave them with an email or a fax number, all right? They can give you their fax number, you can fax it into them, you can send it into them. Email will work as long as it's not too big of a file. Our limit is somewhere between 5 and 10 megabytes. For a return without attachment, I think that's about 3 returns. Oh, I have no idea whether it's 5 or 10. I've had it exclude anything over 5, and I've gotten things as big as 20 megabytes. Completely random. Our computer system is completely ran at this point in time. But anyway, so if you send it in an email, there may be a limitation, you may need to break it up. But my understanding is anyone who's working a Wisconsin case as of today will accept that and amend the proof of claim based on that. They will probably amend the proof of claim within a week's time. That's usually their term. If they haven't amended it, call them. They have a lot of stuff on their plate. Sometimes they don't get it. Okay? If you still haven't gotten satisfaction within a week and a call, fine. File your motions. Go ahead with that. But this way, at least we have a system where we're trying to work it out without litigation. That keeps the U.S. attorney out of it. Insolvency gets a little bit of chance to process things in their normal time frame, and hopefully that will work. Well, you say that's all well and good, Richard, but you know, honestly, you're asking us to do a lot. We've got other things that we have to do. We've got clients. We've got business. It's a lot easier for us just to push the button or ask the paralegal to file the motion. You know, if you have problems with that, if the U.S. attorney has problems with that, you'll have to do it. Okay, I understand that. I was in private practice. I know what it means to have to put together a workable day where you make money. So let me tell you about making money. All right? If you file a motion, I'm not going to be there anymore to work with it. It's going to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice. The U.S. Attorney will handle a certain number of cases, and after that, they're going to throw up their hands and say, we have had enough. All right? As I mentioned to you, the U.S. attorney who has been handling bankruptcy the last couple of years is moving up. The new person's moving in. When that person gets somebody else underneath them, they're going to show them there's nobody else in bankruptcy in the U.S. attorney's office. So they're going to reach a point where they're going to say, I've got too many cases. We're just going to let the Department of Justice handle it. And that's happened. We've had Department of Justice attorneys who have handled cases in Wisconsin. All right? For those of you who have not had the privilege of dealing with them, I can tell you about Department of Justice attorneys. A, they hate Wisconsin. It is a non-existent state as far as they're concerned. B, you make them come in the winter, they really hate Wisconsin. Even if they're staying at the Pfister, they do not want to be walking across the street in the snow and cold. Why do they hate Wisconsin? Well, it's not so much Wisconsin, it's the whole idea of bankruptcy. Department of Justice attorneys don't like doing bankruptcy work because it does nothing for their career. Right? I mean, you've got a big drug case, conservation easement case, something that's going to make your name for your superior, something that's going to enable you to go in at the end of the year and help your achievements and get that value, pay increase to the next grade level up. Bankruptcy will never do that for you. All right. So if you make them come on my state of Wisconsin bankruptcy matter, you're not going to be happy, and they're going to make you the target of their suffering. All right. We had a bankruptcy case a few years ago where the Department of Justice dealt with an objection to a proof of claim. The attorney was kind enough to tell me, I really hate to do this, but I need a placeholder. We've got a confirmation hearing coming up. I need to buy some time. I said, don't file an objection just to get yourself some time. Do something else. It's the easiest way. I'm going to do it. All right? Their firm lost $100,000 before the case finally closed. Department of Justice did discovery. They did trials. They did all sorts of fun things because they did not want to be involved in that case. And they wanted to send a message, and they will send a message the next time they come out here because they want you all to learn they do not want to be involved in bankruptcy cases in Wisconsin. So maybe the first or second time things will go well, but I'm telling you, because I've been talking with them, at some point they're going to say, we're going to send a message to the attorneys in Wisconsin and teach them that if they want us here, it better be important. Okay? So the rest of my talk today will be trying to tell you ways of avoiding the necessity of getting the U.S. attorney involved in the cases. What's the first way? Well, the first way is knowledge, right? A lot of the times you contact me because you need information about the case. Did the taxpayer file returns? If not, I need to get the returns from them. Are there tolling events involved? What's the balance of the taxpayer owes? Basic information. And the basic information you can get online, IRS.gov, our website, and go in and type in get transcript, and you'll have a chance to get tax transcripts. There's different ways of getting it. You can get it by phone, you can get it by mail, you can get it by email. Generally, you have to have the taxpayer there in order to provide the information, but you can get it. Three kinds of transcripts. The first kind is a return transcript. A return transcript is a copy of the actual return filed by the taxpayer. because that's hard for us to do is basically we have to run a copy or a PDF and charge for that. That's $50 a copy. Plus, it only goes back 3 years. So unless there's some reason where you absolutely positively have to have a copy of the return and the taxpayer can't get it for you, don't bother getting a return transcript. The second kind of transcript is what's called a wage and income transcript. That's a transcript that provides all the information that we receive from third parties showing the income your client had for that particular year. So if you have a situation where the client is telling you, I didn't file a return because I didn't have sufficient income. Get a copy of that wage and income transcript and check. Because more likely than not, yes, they had a file or return. They had more than $600 of self-employment income. They had an unemployment compensation. They had Social Security. All the things that ordinary taxpayers are convinced they don't have to pay taxes on, right? But they do. So get a copy of that transcript, take a look at it, and see if, in fact, they did have a filing requirement. And if they really didn't, do an affidavit. Do an affidavit that said the taxpayer had no obligation to file because they had only $50 in income, it was below the reporting requirements, and send that in. The insolvency specialist will take that affidavit, sign it under penalties of perjury, and if it matches the income information we have, which should be the same as what you have because we use the same system to create the wage and income transfer that the insolvency people have, then they will amend the proof of claim to zero and knock off the file requirement. The third kind of transcript is the one that's the most useful. That's the account transcript. Account transcripts go back 10 years. Those are the ones that I use when I deal with you. What is an account transcript? Well, an account transcript starts off with the taxpayer's name and redacted Social Security number, and then goes on to tell you what the balance due is, tax, penalty, and interest, so you can match that up. It may not be identical to the proof of claim because it uses a different algorithm, but it's going to be close enough within a few pennies per day. It will then tell you whether or not the taxpayer has filed a return for that year, and so what kind of return it is. Are you filing separate, are you filing joint, the date of the return, and whether or not it's a substitute for return. Substitutes for return are not tax returns, those are returns you prepare. If it's a substitute for return, it will not hold the statute of limitations and it will not be a dischargeable tax. The transcript will then go on to list all of these significant events in the taxpayer's history for that particular year, any payments that we received, some of the more important notices that went out. And for your purposes, it will also show you any tolling events that took place, any litigation, installment agreements, offers in compromise, collection due process, the things that will extend the statute of limitations in bankruptcy and make the tax dischargeable beyond the ordinary 10-year statute of limitations. Okay? Get that all off the account transcript. It's in plain English. And it will also tell me when we put our freeze on. The litigation code for freeze is a 520, a TC 520. So when you look at the account transcript, there's a column in the left-hand side that has three-digit numbers. Those are our transaction codes. Those are more important to us in the detail that you don't get in an account transcript. But if you're talking to insolvency, you could mention that to them and they can get some additional information based on that. It then has a plain English explanation of what the transaction code means, and in the far corner, it'll have the date and the amount that was involved in that transaction. So when you're dealing with a situation where you have a freeze, the freeze code will be a TC 520 and will see bankruptcy or other litigation. Use that code for anything that stops the statute of limitations from running. So it can be a tax court case, it can be a bankruptcy case, it can be a district court case. It can even be, in certain cases, an offer of compromise. Why is that important? Because if that code is not present on the account transcript, that means that year, that module, we call it, is subject to collection, specifically subject to automated collection, our ACS or automated collection system. So if you do not have a TC 520 on that module, at some point the automated collection system is going to start spitting out notices. You have a balance due. You have a balance due and you need to pay it right now or you're going to take collection action. Notice 3 is a levy was just placed on your account. All right? So if you get one of those notices, your taxpayer gets a notice 30 days after you file for bankruptcy. Again, it takes a little bit of time for the codes to be input by insolvency and for the automated collection system to slow down. There's a problem. And when you have a problem like that, you need to contact the insolvency specialist to let them know so they can put the code in, right? The other time you will not see that code is on post-petition tax sheet. One of the reasons we don't put the code in on post-petition tax order is because if we put the code in, the refunds go out. Okay? Well, clearly your client wants refunds, right? I assume they do anyway. Most of them that I've talked with seem to want that money at the end of the year. So we have to leave the code out. Well, what that means is that they need to be getting collection notices based on post-petition amounts while they're in bankruptcy. Right? And I get the emails from the attorneys. How dare you? Don't you know there's an automatic stay in place? Okay? So this is why that's happening. The main thing is to, at that point, let the insolvency specialist know so that they can put the code in after the refund goes out so that automated collection doesn't continue to apply. Now, if your client owes money within the bankruptcy, they're not going to get a refund. All right? And so let's tell them that when they walk in the door. Two things I would tell them when they walk in the door. Number one, where's your returns? Right? Number two, you're not getting a refund from the government. Owe money to the government, you're keeping that money. Well, you say, I had a client last year who got proof of claim for $10,000 and she got her return. Yeah, because we screw up. It's the IRS computer system is going to make mistakes. I told you that. It's a broken system, right? Don't assume they're going to get it. So this is what's going to happen this year. I can tell starting in the middle of February, after I'm gone, the first calls are going to come in. The taxpayers are going to call the insolvency specialist, right? And they're going to say, where's my refund? I want my money. Some of them call every hour on the hour. Some of them are kinder. They only call once a day or once every other day. Every call that insolvency specialist picks up, even to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you, takes time away from them doing what you need them to be doing, which is amending the proof of claim and making sure everything comes up. So please tell them you're not going to get your refund. Don't call the IRS. If they really want to know what happened to their refund, what's the answer? IRS.gov, right? They can go on IRS.gov, type in, where's my refund? And it has the same refund information that we have. It will tell them. And what will it tell them? It will say pending, because that's what it says in 90% of the cases. Pending simply means that we haven't gotten to it yet. And with the new laws that were enacted last year, we're not going to get to it for a longer period of time than the previous year, because we've got a whole new set of checks and balances that are going in. None of those have been tested yet, so I'm assuming this is going to be a rough year for refunds. Okay? But if the refund has been sent out, that information will be there. The other thing is if the refund went to another agency, the number is in your materials. Don't call the IRS. We have no information. It's all done electronically. The other agencies do not give us any information about what the debt is. We can't do anything about that. Calling the insolvency specialist is not going to get the refund back. When I started here, we had an exception for hardship cases that's gone. Everything is automated now. If the refund goes out, it goes out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. If there's a problem with it and it should have gone out and it doesn't, 6 months is what you're going to have to wait before you can contact anybody. Because even I can't get a refund going faster than that anymore. Why? Remember the monster? It's broken. And if you try to force manual refunds, we're going to have a year like last year where nobody is getting any money. Okay? All right, so I've talked to you about transcripts and getting that information. I've talked to you about processing. I've talked to you about Department of Justice. What else? Hiring, insolvency, 1232, right. Most of you don't deal with Chapter 1232. Those that you would do, I've heard you read the listserv I posted a few weeks ago. There's a provision of the bankruptcy code that applies to family farmers. I know why this happened. I don't like it, but family farmers basically get a free ride in neighbors. Why? Because there's a provision that says that if they sell their farm, they don't have to pay their taxes because it flips from a priority debt to a general unsecured debt. Well, there's two exceptions to that. One of those was a statutory mistake. The statutory mistake was that the sale had to occur prior to them filing for bankruptcy. Right? If they filed after bankruptcy, the exception didn't apply, they paid the capital gains taxes. Well, that really hurt those that didn't know what they were doing, waited until they filed bankruptcy, and then the attorney was like, oh yeah, we can fix this, we'll sell the assets. So Congress fixed that loophole and enacted a change to Section 1232 2 years ago. I inquired at that time whether or not the IRS was going to go along with it. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we say, well, yeah, Congress said X, but we're going to continue to argue that and we'll try it judicially. So I asked our national office, and that's when I found out the national office doesn't have anybody who's interested anymore, right? When I was in national office, we had seven branches, well, seven deterrents, and everything was passed with regional regulatory things, everything that had to do with collection. And 10 of those attorneys did nothing but bankruptcy work, all right? There's one of them left, and he doesn't do bankruptcy work very often. So when I contacted them, he was busy on other stuff, and busy and busy and busy. And finally, he said, yeah, we're going to follow the law, don't worry about it. But, he said, there's a problem, because if they're in bankruptcy, and this is a post-petition debt, we're not going to file a proof of claim. So there's nothing for insolvency to do. Insolvency can't fix the problem. And the problem, of course, is that they have filed a return showing $100,000, $200,000 of capital gains taxes. That's now been assessed against them, right? So in bankruptcy, it's simple. You get your proof of claim or your plan, and after the bankruptcy discharge occurs, you go in and you abate those amounts. Well, if it's a post-petition amount that's not on a proof of claim, how is that going to get abated? It's not. Right? It's not unless you follow the instructions in the listserv. I've told you what to do. Follow those instructions to the letter. If you have any questions, you still have 2 months to call me and ask me for clarification. But if you don't, that amount will not be abated, and your client will be back in your office 4 years from now when the bankruptcy closes saying, I got a bill from the IRS for $200,000. What do I do? Okay. All right, let's see, what else? Manual refunds, 1305 claims. We don't file post-petition claims anymore. Don't ask us to. Some of you over the last couple of years, I said, just file your own claim. Don't worry about it. Don't do that anymore, right? The reason that I don't want you to file your own claims is, again, we don't track them. So if you file a proof of claim on our behalf, it's not in our system. It's not going to prevent collection. Nothing's going to happen with it. And when the money comes in, we're going to take that money and apply it to the bankruptcy debts and not where it's intended. So if your client has a post-petition tax debt, what they need to do is to pay it directly to us as though it's an ordinary tax, right? They need to, on the check, write the year that it's for and send it along with a letter that says, I want this to be applied to my 2019 taxes. Why do a letter? Because hopefully somebody will read that and understand where it's going. Why do they write it on their check? Because, of course, we tear the letter off, and then that letter goes wherever it goes, but it's not staying with the check, right? If they do that, they can pay by installments, they can pay directly, but paying onto the check, because I will tell you in about a quarter of the cases, that money is not going to be applied where it's supposed to be applied. You're going to have to track it down after the fact and figure out where it is. And the only way they're going to do that is if you have the front and back of the check together. Okay? Where do you go with that? Taxpayer advocate. The taxpayer advocate's office is there to do exactly that. If your client made a payment and we're collecting on them for the year that they paid it in, you go to the taxpayer advocate and say, hey, what's going on here? And they will look into it, track that payment down, make sure it's applied. Again, this is the theory. Don't come looking for me. Well, you won't find me anyway. I'm telling you this. When you find me, you just watch for the movies. You won't be able to do anything about it if they don't act. All right? But the taxpayer advocate is there to assist the taxpayer. So generally speaking, they are going to try to do what's best for the taxpayer. If you get involved with the taxpayer, it's going to be much tougher for them because as soon as an attorney gets involved, they kick it to their attorneys, which is us. Us being less than me now, so it'll take more time. Much better for the taxpayer to go directly to the taxpayer advocate and say, look, I made a payment, the IRS sent me this bill, here's a copy of the bill, here's a copy of the payment, and they will help.
All right, direct debit installment agreements, right? So I got a couple of calls on this. How dare you collect from my client? They had an installment agreement, they're in bankruptcy, and now they're getting these collection notices. And worse than the collection notices, you actually levied on the payment. How dare you, right? If your client had an installment agreement before they went into bankruptcy, the installment agreement is suspended during the bankruptcy and will kick in again after the bankruptcy is over with. So, assuming that the debt is not paid in the bankruptcy for whatever reason, they can come out of the bankruptcy and they can resume the installment agreement. If they have a direct debit installment agreement, that simply means that they went to their bank and they had the bank put a automatic withdrawal on it. We didn't do that. We can't stop it. So coming to me and saying, I need you to stop levying, we're not levying. Your client has to go to the bank, and they have to stop it. Okay? And along those lines, I often get calls from angry attorneys, my client is being levied. I say, fine, I need a copy of the notice. They then go to the client to get the notice, and what do they see? Wisconsin Department of Revenue, right? Illinois Department of Revenue, some other federal agency. So before you call for a copy of the notice that they are complaining about, take a look at it. If it is one of our notices, and it very well could be, because you know there are reasons why they count as in COVID, contact me, or after I'm gone, contact Mark Miller. He's the name in your materials. I'll give you his phone number, 414-231-2422. He's my boss. He understands this is going to be happening. He's in his office crying right now. All right, interest rate. Interest rate is 5% right now. Changes quarterly. It was just approved for this year. So keep that in mind when you're doing your secured plans. Take a look. I just look on the internet. You know, what is the federal interest rate? And it'll tell you what it is and whether it's changed or not. Okay. So there's a recent decision in the Long case talking about whether or not you have an obligation to file returns to the current year. And it's been determined that you don't have that obligation. That's fine. Insolvency is going to file an estimated claim and you don't have a return, because that's all we can do, right? So if you get a legal claim that has an estimated amount, please don't call or file an objection. Every year somebody does. File an objection that says that this is wrong. When my client files their return, you'll even see that it's wrong. Well, yeah, okay, file the return, because we can't do anything until we have that return in hand. Right? So please don't tell me you're going to file it, or it's in the works, or it's coming. File it, and then if things don't change, then contact us. Okay? Okay, three more things. Lien releases. So I had a situation that just came up this week. The debtor had paid off all of their secured debt in the bankruptcy, and they wanted to get a release. Okay, that's fine. So how does that happen? Well, the IRS has different things that we do with liens. We do withdrawals of liens when the lien was filed wrongfully. We do subordinations of liens where our lien is behind, like a bank's lien, and they need to sell the property. But the two that are going to affect your clients most often are releases and discharge. What's the difference? A release is where there is no liability, and a discharge occurs when there is liability, but for whatever reason we agree that we're not going to get it, or we're going to get a lesser amount, right? So what should you ask for? Well, most attorneys say, well, I want to protect myself, right? I want to get a release. We don't do releases very often, and we very seldom do them in bankruptcy. Why? Well, this situation is exactly what I was talking about. So the attorney came and said, I want a release. My client has paid in full their obligation in bankruptcy. Here's a copy of the receipt. Okay, that's fine. The case is still ongoing. That means that there are still general unsecured debts that haven't been discharged. So they don't have a zero balance. They still owe. You can't do a release if they owe. Well, he said, but they paid the secured amount. Doesn't matter. The lien attaches to any and all property of the debtor, not just the property attached to in the bankruptcy, not just the exempt property it's going to attach to after the bankruptcy, any and all, right? So you're not going to get a release if the taxpayer owes money, with the small exception of it being a post-petition debt, because, of course, the lien wouldn't have attached to that because of the bankruptcy. So in that case, ask for a discharge. It's a matter of filling out a form and supplying that along with a copy of the bankruptcy paperwork, and they will process the discharge, and your client will get out from under the lien. All right? You say, well, you know, that's work. I have to fill out a form. I have to provide the IRS documents. The law says that they have to give you a release of the debt. The bankruptcy case is closed. My client doesn't owe anything. I am simply going to wait for you guys to issue a release. If you don't, I am going to reopen the bankruptcy case and I'm going to ask for sanctions. Well, the sanctions part is kind of fun because the Supreme Court just came down with a opinion this year in Taggart versus Lorenzen that said basically creditors are liable for contempt of discharge only if there was no fair ground for doubt. I love that phrase, no fair ground for doubt. I will always have doubts. So there's never going to be a situation where I'm going to agree to the stuff that's sanctioned. But in all seriousness, in a situation like that, we're still not going to grant a release because, well, I shouldn't say that. We are going to grant a release, but it's not the release that's going to help you. Because what you're looking for is you're looking for a letter from the IRS that says, my client doesn't owe anything and their property is free and clear. So you can take that to the title company and show them and get them to remove the lien. We don't have the people to do those letters anymore. So what we do, what we have come up with, is an idea that was floating around and started getting implemented in 2014 when our staff started shrinking. That's the concept of a self-releasing lien. So every notice of federal tax lien now that we file has written on it, this lien is good unless and until it's not good anymore. And what the law says is that once we file that, we don't have to do anything more to release it. It automatically releases when it's paid or is no longer effective by operation of law. And that's what you're going to get. You're going to, if you do manage to get a cold lien insolvency person, they're going to say, yes, you're right, there's nothing owed. We have already released that lien. It's on the lien itself. Look at it. And some title companies still don't get that. That's fine. I've got some information in your materials. If you need more, contact me and let me know. I've got a letter that I've sent out to the title companies that I'd be happy to provide you a copy of. Basically says, look, it's a self-releasing lien. The law says we're allowed to do that. We agree that there's no liability owed. You can see that by the bankruptcy discharge papers and the trustee report. Let it go.
Okay. But a lot of the title companies are on board with that, so that's not so much of a problem anymore. All right. Number two, entities in bankruptcy. We have seen in the last 5 years a great increase in entities included in Chapter 13, which never used to be the case. So basically the way it is this. You've got a taxpayer who has an LLC, let's say it's a long-term business, right? And for all intents and purposes, the taxpayer is considered a sole proprietorship entity. They filed with the state, they got the LLC, they got the employer identification number, and that's it. Now they just run their business and they, you know, take the money out when they need it and spend it on whatever they need stuff. And now they need to file for bankruptcy and oh, they've got this business and they've got to, you know, handle the business tax as well. So what has been happening is that the Chapter 13s will have the person and then they'll have doing business as or trading as and then they'll have the LLC. Okay? All right, fine. The courts have accepted that. I understand that. The problem is this. Again, we are a computer-driven organization. We can only work with the information that we have, and we can't manipulate it very well. And one of the things we can't manipulate very well is identifying taxpayers. That's why we still need Social Security numbers. First of all, I don't have any access to the IRS's base computer system, which is the Information Data Retrieval System, IDRS. That's all the information that we get from the tax returns, everything's used to generate transcripts, all the useful information. I can't touch it. When I need to get information on an account transcript, I have to go to somebody on the service side, like an insolvency specialist, and ask them to print me a copy of that. I have to fill out a form. I have to certify that I'm not using this for improper purposes. I'm not trying to get a hold of Elvis's return. I'm not trying to do anything like that. You laugh, but 60 or 70 people a year in the Internal Revenue Service get fired or suspended because they do stupid things, like looking up tax returns they're not supposed to. So we're very guarded about that. But because I can't access that kind of information, and because it's limited, we have specific ways to get that information. And one of the ways is you have to have a Social Security number or an employer identification. If I gave a taxpayer's name, Richard Grossman, to insolvency, they couldn't look me up. All right, they have to have that information. So when they're looking up the taxpayer for purposes of filing proof of claim, what are they going to do? They're going to take the number off of the bankruptcy filings. They're going to look up that Social Security number. They're going to print out all the taxpayers' debts, and they're going to put it in the proof of claim. What is not showing up? Anything under the employer identification number. Any of the 941s, the quarterly business taxes, the employment taxes, none of that is going to show up. So the proof of claim is going to have just the taxpayers' taxes plus any trust fund taxes that happen to roll over. What does that mean? Well, once the bankruptcy is over with, we're going to come looking and we're going to, you're going to say, well, the business is gone. You got shut down when they filed for bankruptcy. You're out of work. No, we're not. We're the IRS. We're used to people telling us the business isn't there anymore, right? We do an alter ego. We do transferee liability. There's lots of ways that we can go after the debtor, and we will. And they're not going to be very happy with you at that point in time. So what you have to make sure is when you're filing your bankruptcy, make sure the employer identification number is on there. If the debtor has a business, make sure that that's on the proof of claim. If it's not, if you don't see something that talks about business taxes and you know there's business taxes, contact the insolvency specialist and say, hey, my client has a business. The business EIN is X. Can you please check to make sure there's no business taxes? Now, there are jurisdictions, specifically Minnesota, Michigan, to speak of two, where they don't include business for any reason in a Chapter 13. I'm still negotiating with them. I don't know if I'll be successful or not, but if they tell you we don't include the business on there, have them talk to Mark, all right? Because if you don't include the business, you're going to have the problem I described. Don't want to do that, so try to work with them on that, because the alternative, what they expect you to do in Minnesota and Michigan, is to file a separate Chapter 11 for a defunct business. You're not going to do that. I understand you're not going to do that. It's harder to explain that to insolvency.
All right, last bit of business, and then I'll be open for questions. If you don't have any questions, I can go to a late lunch.
Secure claims. So when the model plans went into effect a few years ago, I really like the model plans. They made things a lot easier. But there's one provision that created some consternation for us, and that's the treatment of secured claims. All right. So it used to be, before the new model plans, that if the plan didn't have anything about our secured claims, that we put in our proof of claim and we got paid by the trustee. Well, that still works in most cases, but if there's a situation where the debtor files a proof of, a plan, and the plan says we are going to pay the IRS outside of the bankruptcy, all right, the trustee is not going to pay on our proof of claim. They're going to believe that you're going to pay the IRS outside of bankruptcy. Okay? And that's fine if we get paid outside of bankruptcy. But remember what I told you before. We don't have any way of tracking this. If your client is sending in payments on that secured claim, we don't know. We may be applying those to the priority debt. We may be applying those to the general and secured debt. So if you're going to pay the IRS outside of bankruptcy, make sure that those payments are properly addressed to the specific claim that they're supposed to go through, or you will have problems later on. All right? Well, what about the situation where the debtor or the plan says that the IRS will be paid outside of the plan, and we're not paid outside of the plan? What happens then? No, I don't know. This was the year that I was hoping to solve that problem, because I was going to find one of you lucky folks and I was going to sue your client, right? And find out if we can in fact collect outside of the bankruptcy, because I don't think it's a matter of lifting the stay. I mean, if you're paying us outside of the bankruptcy and you're not, if there's nothing in the bankruptcy for the judge to decide, right? So I would presume that that would allow us to go after any exempt property, because that's not subject to the bankruptcy court, but I'll be in attaches to it, and sell that and collect on it. And what is the most common kind of exempt property in a bankruptcy with your clients? School furnishings. Haven't had one of those sales in a while. I've done it. Clients don't like it too much. Debtors don't like it too much, but it's effective. Okay? Won't get a chance to do that. I don't know how that's going to be treated in the future, but it is a problem. All right? So if you have that situation where you have a client who has a secured claim, and for whatever reason, most often because it's going to bust the plan if you have to include it, and you say, look, I'm just going to pay the IRS outside of the plan, make sure you've got provisions for that, because at some point or another, that is going to wind up in the Department of Justice's lap. And from my discussion earlier, you know where that's going to end up. All right. So I'll take questions, but I just wanted to say I have been practicing law now for a long time. And of all that, I was fortunate enough to, when I got out of law school, not have any mentors or anything. My family, my grandfather, my grandfather's grandfather, they were all in the restaurant business, right? So that was my background. And they wanted a lawyer because they wanted a lawyer to get them off the hook, right? I am doing what I am doing because my family is a family of tax cheats. They've all been in jail. My uncle is still on the run. His own family doesn't know where he is. Somewhere on the East Coast in a van driving back and forth to various markets, because we're still looking for him. All right?
So when I got out of law school, I had a chance to try all, and I've tried every kind of law. There is everything but admiralty. I've done family law, I've done criminal law, I've done states and taxation, I've done personal injury. You name it, I've done it. And the one that was the most fun for me was Bankers, because it really gave me a chance not only to try a lot of things and be creative, but, you know, I really like working with bankers, the attorneys. I mean, you deal with family law attorneys, you deal with personal injury attorneys, it can get rough. But bankruptcy attorneys, generally speaking, I mean, you know, we kind of got a lot of things in common going. You all are overworked. You're all underpaid, right? And at the end of the day, the bottom line is what good you have done for your client and for the justice system. Not that much different from a government attorney, is it? Yes.
The wage and income transcript still doesn't have Wisconsin withholding on it, does it?
Just federal.
So file the state return, claim zero, and they'll give you credit for whatever they think there is there?
So in other words,
can you repeat the question so the people at remote locations hear it?
So basically the question was on the wage and income transcript that the IRS provides. Does that include any information for the state of Wisconsin? It does not. So the gentleman asked, well, in that case, what do you do? And I assume you wouldn't put on your federal return?
No, on the Wisconsin return, just zero withholding, and then let the Department of Revenue say, oh, no, there was $1,500.
Well, presumably you will be able to get withholding information from the state because they actually have people working for them, so you can contact their bankruptcy people and get that information from them. We're a little bit more limited than they are.
Thanks.
If you go through the state, actually, you get a copy of the W-2 itself. So, like, if your client hasn't filed state or federal taxes and they need to get wage transcripts, they should just go to the state because they're going to have to get them there anyway. And it's a photocopy of the actual W-2, so it's just federal and state withholdings. It's very useful.
And so really general, though, this is an unbankruptcy related. We've got a really good working relationship with the state tax department. So if you have a situation where you have multiple liens and you're not sure about the priority, the state and the IRS will work that out for you. You know, you just have to worry about cutting the check. We'll divide up the proceeds. Yes?
You spoke at Kohler a few years back about a line of cases in other parts of the country. I want to say it was a case called Mallow that basically said that if you didn't file a timely tax return, that fact alone would cause that tax debt to never be dischargeable. And what you said back then was the IRS wasn't following that line of cases around here, but that could change any day.
Haven't changed yet.
Okay. That's really what I was wondering.
So on a follow-up, is the cutoff when the IRS files the substitute return?
Right. And basically, our statute of limitations, if you haven't filed a return, it stays open indefinitely. Right? We can always go back if there's been no return. But for various purposes, we have to have an assessed amount before we can collect. Right? So we do that through IRC Section 1620. 1620A allows us to do a return with the assistance of the taxpayer. In other words, you could literally walk into an IRS office, used to be able to anyway, and lay out all your receipts and everything, and the IRS would do the return for you. Okay. 6020B says we can do the same thing, but without the taxpayer's cooperation. So we can sit there and use our wage and income information, and we can create a return for the taxpayer. Well, that's got two deleterious effects for your clients. Number one is they're not going to get any exemptions, any deductions, any benefits. And number two is, in the bankruptcy code, if you have a 6020B return, it is not considered to be a return for purposes of determining whether a tax is dischargeable. So those taxes will forever follow your clients. Okay. Go ahead. They both talk at once.
Is there a specific person that a Chapter 7 trustee can now contact to determine the status of their response to our 505B letters?
I call, if you really need to get help as a Chapter 7 trustee, call Mark. Mark's advantage, he doesn't know bankers, but he knows everybody in the IRS. All right, so he actually can contact people who can get things done, which is an enormous benefit. The problem, of course, is Mark is now running the office with
half the attorneys he had 2 years ago, and so he's kind of stressed right now. So try not to call him unless you have to, but if you have to, he will get out. And, oh, by the way, as far as replacing me, so we're now down to George, Lori, Eric, okay, and Jackie. George can't do bankruptcy work because of internal politics. Basically, the folks down in Chicago that are in charge of our office have made a determination that it's too valuable for tax litigation, so we can't be bothered with anything other than tax litigation. So those three remaining attorneys, two of them have done some bankruptcy work. They basically were the transitions between the time that Mark Peterson was running things and I came to work. Jackie is a transfer from national office. She's got about 5 years left. None of them like bankruptcy. All of them are desperate to get out of bankruptcy. And they, when we sat down to determine how my work was going to be carved out, it was really one of those musical chair things where they're like, he's going to do it. No, she's going to do it. No, he's going to do it. So they are hiring an attorney to replace me. That was one of my preconditions to going. That lady, Allison Krushke, will be coming on board in October of next year. She is a 3L student at Michigan State. She graduates in May and has to take the bar. She has a background in nonprofits, so she didn't go like straight to law school. She has no collection background or bankruptcy background whatsoever. Nor does she have any interest in it. Let's go with her about it. So basically, you're going to be dealing with a person who doesn't want to be doing bankruptcy. When you call, Mark says, oh, Eric's going to take that, or Lori's going to take that. They'll do the best they can, but recognize that, again, you're so short-handed right now, they're desperate. And I'm going to tell you something. So the IRS, as you know, way down in staff. Counsel's saying that we've got about half the attorneys we did 5 years ago. So they've had to make a decision what they're going to focus on, right? And what they're going to focus on is tax litigation. That is 90% of the work we're going to be doing moving forward until we staff up again. Right? There aren't attorneys doing bankruptcy work anymore. When I started, they had two classes that all new attorneys, the Joint Chief Counsel, had to go through. One was a tax litigation class, that was a week. And one was a bankruptcy school, that one week. The bankruptcy school hasn't been taught to it since 2015. None of the new hires are learning bankruptcy, because they don't expect counsel to learn bankruptcy work. They kick that to the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney. Right? The Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney are like, it's an IRS guy, we don't want to handle it. Right? So you guys are caught in the middle. Mark, being the person that he is going to try to work with you as much as possible, but recognize there really isn't anybody that's going to be there, and that's why I'm urging you, if you can, try to work within the system. If you can't, call Mark. Yeah.
So on a lighter note, do you, starting in about 2 months, do you envision a context or occasion when you're going to have to utter the word module ever again?
Yeah, actually. I do organs on the side, and there's a lot of modules involved. So I'm going to be here for a while. Anybody wants to come up and ask me specific questions? I am around for 2 more months. I have some new release time that I'm going to be taking, so I'm not going to be there like every day. But that said, they're actually trying to take things away from me, give me time to hopefully provide training sessions for our own people. So that's what I'll be working on over the next 2 months, is telling them the wonders of bankruptcy and probate and the various collection stuff I've been working on. I'm more than happy to work with you to answer any questions that you have. I apologize that things aren't going to work out better. There are some significant problems that are going on in the solvency right now because the supervisory personnel are in a great state of flux. The supervisor that handles Wisconsin is a lady in Chicago. She just took a transfer, and the new supervisor in Chicago has no managerial experience whatsoever. Okay. Nor does she know how to fix a lot of the problems that we have. So I'm going to be working with her, but Chicago is an entity unto themselves, and I'm telling you, I would give you her number if I thought she would respond to you. She won't. She won't. So Mark will hopefully be able to get to her boss and get that pushed. But the attorney in the national office that had the power over the bankruptcy just got a promotion as well. He's working for the actual chief counsel now. So even that's fine.
5 years from now, it could very well be that we just aren't doing bankruptcy. It's going to be a totally automated system. 5 years from now, maybe insolvency will be staffed up again. Honestly, I have no idea. All right, but in the meantime, it's going to be a very bumpy road. So do the best you can to encourage the insolvency people when you talk with them. I always cringe when I hear that, you know, Linda especially, you know, I called the office and I tried to tell them what I needed and they, you know, they said, okay, I can't understand you and hung up the phone. As I said, they've got their some significant physical issues. So they're going to be slower. It's going to be harder for them to do things, but they are great to work with and they will do it for you if they at all possibly can. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard, for the jam-packed, painfully candid presentation.